Although his newest book, Campus Sex Pot, is not a novel, nor is it even ostensibly fiction, it is vintage David Carkeet. Perhaps Carkeet at his best. Once again, local writer John Dalton calls it, quote, an addictive joy to read, end quote. And it's true. Whoever thought creative nonfiction could be such a page-turner? You can devour this book in a night. Part coming-of-age memoir, part critique of middle-class sexual mores in the early 1960s, part tribute to a very compelling father in a lost small town in America, the book can also function as a handy-dandy writer's manual, as it joyfully and skillfully critiques the 1962 potboiler Campus Sex Pot, written by a man who briefly taught English at Carkeet's own Sonora, California high school. One of these chapters appeared in the recent River Styx anniversary issue, though in a much different version. The piece works better in this form for the book as a whole, but Carkeet cut out something essential about himself and his writing. Both the chapter and the essay discuss de Molay, a kind of secret society that thrived in small towns across the United States, a kind of Masons for Cub Scouts organization, emphasizing ritual and not much else. Carkeet writes, as for actual moral training, any argument for a benefit from exposure to the seven preceptors' virtues assumes actual merit to the virtues in question. He then lists for us the seven de Molay virtues: filial love, reverence for sacred things, courtesy, comradeship, fidelity, cleanness, and patriotism. After a blistering critique of these seven virtues, I'm sure he's very clean. After a blistering critique of these seven virtues, Carkeet lists his own seven virtues, the personal jewels for his own crown of youth: compassion, honesty, curiosity, independence of thought, industry, precision, and humor. One reason I love the essay we published is I love this list. Old or young, we should all wear a crown of such personal jewels. This list also explains why we like David Carkeet as a person. And unlike any other writer I know, I don't know anyone who doesn't like him.
How about Del Kobe?
Well, he's dead. Any living person. He embodies the principles of this list. And not surprisingly, so does his writing. His newest book, indeed, Carkeet as a writer, is nothing if not compassionate, honest, curious, independent of thought, industrious, precise, and funny. Doubtless, that's why Campus Sex Pot won the 2005 Association of Writers and Writing Programs Award in Creative Nonfiction. His novels, three of which were named New York Times Notable Books, include Double Negative, The Greatest Slump of All Times, I've Been There Before, The Full Catastrophe, and The Error of Our Ways, set in Clayton's High Point de Mun neighborhood. Carkeet's short stories and essays have appeared in the North American Review, the Oxford American, the New York Times Magazine, the Village Voice, St. Louis Magazine, and again, forthcoming in our next issue, River Styx. Having recently retired from teaching in St. Louis, Carkeet now lives and writes in Vermont. Please welcome longtime friend of River Styx, and yet enemy of none, David Carkeet.
Well, I can't speak to its accuracy, but that's the nicest introduction I've ever had in my life. When we moved to Vermont, let me say a word about de Molay before I forget that organization. Are there any former de Molays in the room? Well, maybe it wasn't. See, a lot of you are from St. Louis, so I don't know. It was founded by a guy named Frank Land, who actually was a St. Louisan, and he grew up on Euclid, of all things. This wasn't in the essay, and I don't think I shared it with Richard. And he achieved some fame in the around the turn of the century, I guess, as a boy preacher. And then he and his mother moved to Kansas City because there was alcoholism in the family. They had problems with his father. And at Kansas City, he established this Junior Masonic organization. It is very much a feeder organization for the Masons. But I was struck in doing research for the River Styx essay that I published in the last issue, and thanks to them for doing that, struck at the St. Louis Euclid connection of all things. But you don't hear about him much around here. I lived here for 30 years. I've never heard him mentioned, so there's a Post-Dispatch article for you. when we moved to Vermont 2 years ago, after living in St. Louis for 30 years, we knew no one there, and we're near Montpelier, and being a small town, Montpelier is full of people who know each other, and they tend to stop and chat in the street. And when I first got there, I envied the comradeship, of course, and the envy turned into irritation after a while, and I wanted to ask them to move along. You have nothing to talk about. Will you please get out of my way? Then I began to imagine the streets with friends of mine from St. Louis and former students. It was easy to sort of glimpse them, and, you know, until they turned around and it wasn't them, especially former students, since they do pop up in your life when you don't expect them. But I knew an expectation there finally was out of the question. And that summer and fall, I would scan the stands on TV during the Cardinals games, looking for familiar faces. And then, yeah, it's pretty sad. Yeah. It sounds like Jason over there. And then last spring, while I was waiting at O'Hare Airport to make a connection to fly to California, I noticed, as I was wandering around just killing time, a gate with the announcement, St. Louis. This was a flight bound for St. Louis. I said to myself, well, I'll know someone here. So I entered the gate area and stood there and scanned the faces one after another, and no luck, no luck at all. And as I walked away, I kind of imagined someone who had seen me saying, did you see what Carkeet was doing? Isn't that the most pathetic thing you've ever seen? So today, I've been in St. Louis for a couple days, and it's just been constant society. I've talked more in the past 2 days to people outside my family than I have in the past 2 years. And in time, of course, I'll have some friends in Vermont. I already do. But it's been really nice, and it's really nice to return to this this ancient creaky podium and this stage here in Duff's, where I always enjoy reading. Richard gave a great introduction to the book, and many of you know what it's about. I'm going to, and why it's called Campus Sex Pot of all things, I'm going to read the opening chapter, and then a little bit from a later section. The opening chapter is also an introduction to the book, pretty much speaks for itself. If you've seen the book, a lot of people don't know this, the cover art is a photo of me, actually, as a freshman in high school, kissing the tallest and most beautiful, I believe, senior girl. I was very short, kind of a shrimp, and I was real useful for as a prop for certain events like the mistletoe kiss photo for the newspaper Christmas issue. So they summoned me for this kiss where I'm standing on the chair, and I happened to hang on to that photo, the glossy of it, and University of Georgia Press was nice enough. They liked it after they laughed for a couple days, and they liked it. Nice enough to use it on the cover. But a lot of people don't know that it's me. I think it's such a nice photo. They think it's staged or archival or it's actors or something, but that's me with my wavy hair. Linda Franklin had not been to bed with every boy in the junior college of Wattsville, but at 19 she had known physical intimacy with a high percentage of those boys who knew enough to appreciate her amply endowed body. As first sentences go, it's a good one. It treats Linda Franklin's promiscuity like a familiar subject. It shows a touch of wit in its sober contradiction of a preposterous assertion, had not been to bed with every boy in the junior college. And its categorical precision, a high percentage of those boys who, tells us we're in the hands of an author with a working mind. But I did not see these strengths when I first read these words. I was 15 years old, the year was 1962, and to me the opening sentence was a mounting wave that swelled to the climax of amply endowed body. To a small town boy in 1962, amply endowed body was like two large breasts slapping him in the face. I'd come home late from an out-of-town wrestling match to find my mother, her cheeks aflame, reading Campus Sexpot. It was without a doubt her first and last smutty book. She was reading it because everyone else in town was reading it, and they were doing so because its author was a former local high school English teacher who had vanished in the middle of the school year and gone off to write a sexy pulp novel set in our little mountain community. Many recognizable citizens, their names only slightly altered, misbehaved in its pages. "This is terrible," my mother declared from under her reading lamp. "But you let me read it." And after I did, I burned it in the backyard incinerator. In those days, burning paper products outdoors was a regular practice. Linda smiled and nodded to the many boys of her acquaintance as she walked down the aisle of the auditorium on the first day of school. Carolyn had saved her a seat in the section reserved for seniors. The author's fictional milieu gives him a little trouble here. Having chosen to locate his action in a junior college, he nonetheless retains the trappings of the actual high school behind the story. Assembly on the first day of school, incongruous designations like seniors. How could an author capable of such a good opening sentence be this clueless? Linda was a pretty girl, standing only 5'3", gray eyes, amply endowed breasts, with a body that stirred longing in any man who looked at her. The reader of page 2 is gratified to learn that no change has occurred in Linda's body since page 1. Once amply endowed, always amply endowed. She had learned to use her body for her own gratification at an early age, for at 15 she'd been seduced by an older boy visiting the mountain community. At first she had not understood what he wanted, but she had relinquished herself to him in the back seat of his car in order not to appear a poor sport. I read this now and think what I must have thought when I read it in 1962. Why didn't my dates ever worry about appearing to be poor sports? By the third night they spent together, the dam of passion within her broke. She experienced a wild frenzy of delight, twisting and crying out with a barbarous abandon that frightened and at the same time pleased her partner. After that, she spent most of her waking hours looking forward to their next meeting. Ah, yes, the third night. According to the mythology of the era, the third date was when it happened. But what happened exactly? Here, no clothes are removed, no organs produced. An alien reader of this text would think that earthly sexual intercourse consisted of twists and shouts. That these circumlocutions could arouse me, and I'm sure they did, shows that how little sexual stimulation my world gave me, apart from the products of my own 15-year-old mind, but nothing can come from nothing. Also, one has to wonder what this stoic visitor experienced while Mustang Sally bucked in the back seat. Didn't his dam break too? But I didn't ask these questions then. I was too busy learning about sexual response in the human female. This was my lover's manual, my joy of sex. Drive, park, find your date's ignition, and turn her on. When her seducer had to return to his home in the valley, she found that a large number of boys of her acquaintance could provide her with the physical satisfaction she craved. It would come as no surprise to the townsfolk hunched over this novel that it was a valley boy who deflowered Linda Franklin. On the golden mountaintops of Sonora, California, we knew that the distant fog below hid unspeakable evil. Back to the assembly. The curtain of the auditorium was raised, and the principal, Harold Stoper, delivered his speech welcoming the students back to school. He uttered the usual meaningless platitudes. "Crap," muttered Linda. "Oh, Linda," protested Carolyn, "I wish you wouldn't talk that way." "You're too nice," Linda whispered in reply. "Sometimes I think you're goody-goody." Harold Stoper is really Principal Harold Stoller, whose voice I associate with the delivery of the news, to me personally, of JFK's death in my senior year. It was during the lunch hour. I'd been sequestered in a back room of the principal's office, taking a special exam for some interscholastic competition. Like Linda's friend Carolyn, I was goody-goody. I had gone into that room wondering about the fate of my president, who had been reported shot and taken to a Dallas hospital. When I came out, exam in hand, Stoller piped without feeling, "He's dead!" I wanted to strangle him. So evidently did the author of Campus Sexpot, whose name, I should tell you now, is Dale Coby, K-O-B-Y. "I want to introduce the new faculty members," the fat principal squeaked in his high-pitched feminine voice. First is Mr. Don Cowfield, who will teach English." Don Cowfield stood up near the front of the auditorium, and the students craned their necks to get a look at him. "That's our English teacher," Carolyn said. "He looks nice." "Yes," murmured Linda, "I like him." "Such broad shoulders." Don Cowfield, at 30,
had a healthy tan that suggested the outdoors and clear brown eyes that were topped by a head of blonde hair. He stood and smiled at the staring students, accustomed, after 5 years of teaching in another school, to the interested gaze of a youthful audience. His tweeds suggested a pipe, which, in fact, he fingered in the pocket of his jacket while he faced the students. He was muscularly built, with deep brown eyes, didn't we already say that, that glinted with amusement as he met and returned the collective gaze of the assembled students. This is one of my favorite paragraphs in the book. The best part is the way the narrator seems to happen upon the pipe in the tweed pocket, which in fact he fingered. You just can't beat that. But how does Dale Coby measure up to Don Caulfield? In the Sonora Union High School yearbook of 1961, the author appears in two photographs. He's dark-haired, not blonde. Broad-shouldered, not obviously, and he looks short. His eyes glint with something like amusement, yes, but zaniness seems a better word. In one photo, he perches cross-legged on his classroom desk, an open umbrella whimsically balanced on a shoulder. In the other photo, he stands before the blackboard, glowering at the camera, eyes crossed, his lips clenching a piece of chalk like an unlit cigarette. In sum, pipe-fingering Don Caulfield, in this introductory paragraph, is a cool observer of the teenage veil of tears. Dale Coby, in these yearbook photographs, is an imp. Back in the auditorium, the first day assembly breaks up, and the students begin to head off to class. As Don Caulfield passes Linda's seat, she introduces herself to him and joins him in the aisle. She let herself be pressed next to him more than was really necessary as they walked up the aisle. Don was conscious of the sensuous warmth of the young girl pressing closely to him. I know what Don felt. I, too, had a strange girl press up against me at this high school. When it happens, it's an exciting time to be alive. I was at a school dance, standing in the middle of the floor. Perhaps a song had just concluded and my dance partner had left me. At any rate, I was quite alone, with no jostling crowd around me. I suddenly felt a soft, pillow-like pressure against my back. I turned to find Marcia Labateur, the contours of her amply endowed breasts, obvious despite the heavy covering of burlap she wore. The event was a costume dance, though I'm not sure what she was dressed as. A sack of melons? She said, "Excuse me," and walked on, leaving me to my thoughts. A bit later, I tracked her down and asked her to dance. It was a slow dance, ideal for my next move. I asked her to the prom. Before that night, we had never spoken to each other. She was a sophomore, I was a junior. But I must have felt the time was right to strike. I suppose I'm fortunate that I didn't propose marriage. My invitation to the prom made her jerk with surprise. It was not a pleasant sight. I had regrets. I had regrets already. And then she said, "Sure." That settled, I asked her if I could give her a ride home that night. I had already worked out a detour that would take us to a remote parking spot in the woods. Her response was breasts. She probably said yes, but I heard breasts. The next thing I remember is my hand going to burlap and being removed again and again. I tried several times, working her like a slot machine that wouldn't pay off. I figured that her private rule book required her to make a certain number of rejections, and if the payoff number was X plus one, only a fool would stop at X. I also thought that if she had an absolute personal prohibition, as was beginning to seem the case, I might arouse her to the point where passion would break the barrier. But the magic paw wasn't working that night. I finally started the car, wondering where I had gone wrong. What were the rules? Was I allowed to feel her breasts only with my back? Should I have suggested we get out of the car so she could press her breasts against my back again? And what about the prom, the capstone social event of the year? For my sins, I now had a date booked with a virtual stranger who no doubt thought very little of me as I did of her. What had I been thinking, that she would be so flattered that she would open her gunny sack for me? Had my invitation been that calculating? When we reached her house, I walked her to the door. I was always polite that way, and made a bid for retraction. I said, "I don't think we're really cut out for each other." She blinked, but said nothing. Her silence told me that she intended to hold me to the invitation. For the next several weeks, I tried to break my foot. I would jump and land on it awkwardly. I tried dropping a brick on it, but I would pull my foot away at the last instant. So I did what I had to do on prom night. I put on my suit, let my mother attach my boutonniere to my lapel, and drove to Marcia's house. When she opened the front door, I almost sprang back in alarm. Her satiny blue dress was cut in such a way that the entire top half of her bosom was open for public viewing. My mind raced as I drove to the prom, where I got lots of elbow pokes from the guys. Lucky you, they said. But in the end, there was never any doubt about what I would do. When the prom was over, I drove Marcia straight home, accompanied her to the door, said goodnight, spun on my heel, and walked away fast. In the wordless sexual community of adolescence, every gesture carries meaning. And my meaning was, I'm not interested in your breasts. I haven't even seen your breasts. Breasts, never heard of them. Don't care if I ever do. I don't know if the message was received. I do know that a few weeks later, Marcia let it be known to some girls whose opinion I valued that she was shocked and disappointed when, after the spring costume dance, David Carkeet got fresh with her. Luckily, the story spread only so far, then stopped. I heard about it from a grinning friend, himself not exactly blameless in these matters. His favorite phrase and unattained goal was, quote, hands in the pants, unquote. He relished informing me that Marcia had told the tale to Bonnie and Sandy, and I imagine that they, too, were shocked and disappointed. But then, to my surprise, there was no further mention of it. Evidently, my reputation as goody-goody would be sullied no further. David Carkeet got fresh would not appear in the program notes for graduation, where, as student body president-elect, I would lead the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I was relieved that the story had faded, but I also felt betrayed. No, not betrayed exactly, misrepresented. What about prom night, I wanted to shout to the world. Doesn't that count for anything? My hands are clean. Let us return to our story. Linda Franklin has Mr. Cowfield in her last day of last class of the day. A convenient arrangement, it will turn out. After class, she hangs around to chat and pretends to have missed the bus so that her teacher will offer her a ride home. He does, and just then her lover of the month, Mike, sticks his head in the door to see if she's coming with him. She tells Mike she has a ride and sends him away. There follows some banter between teacher and pupil. You don't usually ride the bus, do you? Nope, she laughed. But now Mike's gone, so you have to depend on me for a ride, he said wryly, running his hand through his hair. You've very neatly maneuvered me where you want me, haven't you, young lady? She smiled a saucy smile. Her shoulders sloped into an enticing curve as she tipped her head sideways. If you think so, she said pertly. You need a good spanking for behavior like that, he said. You know what's coming next. Why, Mr. Cowfield, she said, her long eyelashes lowered. Who's going to spank me? Let's change the subject, Linda. He was sorry he had mentioned it. Look, I'll meet you out by the faculty parking lot in 20 minutes. All novelists know that internal conflict is hard to render. The apprentice novelist, which Dale Coby emphatically is, shows it by having his character lurch abruptly from one pole to the other. Don is obviously getting hot, what with all the saucy modifiers flying around, and his passion elevates him to the high wit of his spanking proposal. But when he says, let's change the subject, Linda, the reversal is so incompetent that my mother's this is terrible echoes down memory's corridor with a fresh double meaning. Linda was waiting for him by his car. She wore, besides her white blouse, a white dirndl with large black roses on it, held out by several stiff petticoats. A cummerbund accentuated her tiny waist. White flats with sharply pointed toes completed the picture. And a hell of a picture it is. Sometime between the classroom banter and this meeting in the parking lot, Linda has gone off and joined the League of German Girls. Don drives Linda home and pulls to a stop in front of her house, which is hidden in the woods. In a rural county, make-out venues are around every corner. Well, goodbye, Mr. Cowfield, she said. Thanks for the ride. She turned to face him, leaning forward invitingly. Her skirts rustled with the peculiar sound of starched petticoats. He looked deep into her gray eyes, let his own wander over her lush young form, caressing each molded curve with his gaze. She took his hand, and he pulled her to him, clasping her closely, crushing her firm young breasts against his chest. Their lips met, and hers opened to meet him. They clung for one long, rapturous moment, glued together by the passion both felt. Then he pushed her from him roughly, She half lay in his lap, looking up at him. "This isn't right, Linda," he said brusquely. "I'm a married man, and you're hardly more than a child." Where to begin? Again, Don knows not what he wants, and the lurching becomes physical here, with poor Linda bearing the brunt of it. The tangible world is an enemy to a writer. It's so easy to get things wrong. If, in fact, he pushed her from him roughly, how could the result be that she half lay in his lap without an intervening rebound that must be described? Behind every porno novelist is an aspiring real novelist, and the flashes of art are unintentionally poignant. Don parks the car. Linda leans forward invitingly. What will happen now? Her skirts rustled with a peculiar sound of starched petticoats. This magnificent disharmony comes right out of the real world, where small moments of humanity intrude on our lust. It reminds me of the moment in The Catcher in the Rye when Holden Caulfield is distracted by the dress of the prostitute who comes to his room. He wonders about its purchase. Did the clerk know she was a prostitute? J.D. Salinger and Dale Coby share a moment in their scaling of Parnassus. There's room on the ledge for both of them, at least for the duration of one sentence. But whereas Salinger will resume the ascent to artistic heights, Coby will plunge into the abyss. Nothing further happens between Don and Linda. Today, at least, rocks will not be gotten off. Chapter one. Chapter one concludes with Don driving home and congratulating himself for his restraint. After all, he says to himself, Linda might talk and thus get them both into trouble. And we certainly know what that's like. The next few chapters continue in that vein with me quoting sections of Campus Sexpot, making fun of them, associating from them to my own past, and that developed as a rule, basically. I could not talk about, every book has a rule that the writer self-imposes, I could not talk about my past unless an event was triggered by some mention of something in Campus Sexpot. It's a rule that I came to resent because it's a limited book, and that irritation triggered the beginning of a chapter. I'll just read you a few of these sentences. The chapter that begins, in Campus Sexpot there are no magazines or newspapers. In Campus Sexpot there is no money. In Campus Sexpot there are no sports. Porn happens in a vacuum. Just as sexual arousal chases all other considerations from the mind, a writer with sex as his subject neglects the rest of human experience. In Campus Sexpot there is no food, there is no television, there is no music. There's no recreation, no roller skating, no picnics, no fishing, no swimming, no water skiing. There's no religion, and there's no world politics, no Khrushchev, no De Gaulle, no Lumumba, and so on. And that was a genuine lament. I felt limited, and I had to sort of modify the rule. I certainly don't continue to begin chapters with quotes from Coby. Sometimes I begin chapters with sort of general memoiristic thoughts, and then cite examples from Campus Sexpot going in the opposite direction, such as the chapter that begins, What is a Small Town? I want to read a few paragraphs from that chapter to conclude. In a sense, the book is about three men. It's about me, it's about Coby, and it's about my father. I've presented a little bit of myself, an undersized, sanctimonious, virtuous, goody-goody in band and so on. Coby taught at this high school for just 18 months. He was not my teacher. He taught juniors and seniors, and I overlapped with him for just one semester, the beginning of my freshman year, and then he disappeared in January, and no one knew where. He did have my brother in class, though. My brother's 3 years older than me. We know this, if there was any doubt, from my brother's yearbook, where Coby wrote, next to his faculty photo, Karkit, wake up. The third man the book is about is my father, who was a superior court judge. He served three terms, a total of 18 years, and was, I can say, and I think everyone in Tuolumne County or Sonora would agree with me, the most revered man in the county for about three decades. And so it was a challenge to be a goody-goody. There was extra pressure to be a goody-goody, considering he was my father. Let me just share a few of these paragraphs with you. What is a small town? Let's turn to the local newspaper for an answer, the Union Democrat, established 1854. We'll pick a date and see what tendrils the stories send out. January 4th, 1962 is a good one, for in that issue's campus letter, written by the newspaper editor's teenage daughter, we find the first public discussion of our subject. Dale Coby, I'm quoting from this teenage writer's article now. Dale Coby, former Sonora High English teacher, has written a book, Campus Sexpot. It is the most talked about literature in school. You could make a fortune by selling copies of it for $10 or more. Because there aren't many available and everybody wants to read it, characters and settings are taken without much change from Sonora High School. Everyone wants to know if he's in it. The editor himself will have more to say about the book in the next day's paper, but let's see what else there is of interest in this issue. Right next to the campus letter is a report of some Main Street hubbub. A car with a jammed accelerator crashed into the display window of a clothing store and, quote, a mannequin was knocked from its feet and fell over the front of the car, prompting some spectators to call for help for a man they believed had been pinned by the car. This happened at Calvert's Store for Men, the very clothing store where I fuss-potted over snap-tab shirts and stifled murderous impatience while customers failed to make up their minds. Employment, I recall, is a 2-year coma that turned me into a mannequin. I was not made for retail sales. I wasn't there for this mishap, but Police Chief Ron Wano was, according to the newspaper. Ron was my Pony League baseball coach, a soft-spoken man who would hang his sidearm on the dugout fence and methodically hit ground balls to us through 100-degree July afternoons, oblivious to the sweat blackening his blue police uniform. Ron Wano was a Native American. We all assumed he was a Miwok Indian. A Miwok was a very small tribe from that part of the Sierras that led interesting lives. But I learned in doing research for this book that everyone's assumption was wrong. He's a Potawatomi Indian. He had moved to California from Oklahoma, in fact. A story on page 5 of this same issue hits closer to home. DeMolay Mothers Elect Officers, announces the bold headline. The landmark event occurred, quote, at the Ross Carkeet home on Myers Hill, where, quote, Mrs. Carkeet was named decorations chairman. If contemplating life as viewed from the dizzying heights of DeMolay Mothers decorations chairman has you panting for more, consider this item from the same issue. The Sonora High School Dixieland Band will play for the Fireman's Ball tonight. Members of the band include Stan Moe, David Carkeet, and so on. What is a small town? A small town publishes a newspaper that makes the reader feel comfortable. On a typical day, it's about people he knows and places he's been. On a good day, it's about him. 24 hours later, in his regular column titled The Sierra Lookout, the newspaper editor weighed in on Campus Sexpot. It was a tricky column to write. This is a town of just about 2,500 when I was growing up. What's your Coby name, he begins, quoting a question often heard on campus, thanks to, quote, a former teacher who arrived in a goatee and left a year and a half later without the goatee. The column gives the Coby names of several faculty in the book without identifying the originals, but everyone in town could easily do that. The sexual content of the novel is never directly broached, only implied by the book's title and the word potboiler to refer to it. The editor claims not to have read it. My information is incomplete and secondhand, he says. The book isn't available locally, and most of those who have found it on out-of-town book racks say they haven't been able to finish it. The innocence of the village has been largely preserved. He concludes, more complete information is available from the publisher. Art Enterprises, 8511 Sunset Boulevard, Los Angeles 26. Sonorans didn't want information. They wanted the damn book. The editor managed to facilitate its acquisition without seeming to encourage the reading of it. Clearly, he was the smartest man in town. Other items of interest in this issue, at the bottom of the front page, right below the Sierra Lookout, is an ad inviting everyone to sample the chicken livers or sweetbreads sautéed in Marsala wine sauce at Pastorini's Longhorn Restaurant. I vied for a girlfriend with this restaurateur's son, Dan Pastorini. I got the girl, then lost her to another. Young Pastorini had bigger livers to fry. He went on to become starting quarterback for the Houston Oilers in the 1970s. And I was quite unpleasant to watch football games with, and I'd say, I got his girlfriend. I took his girlfriend. And what was Judge Carkeet up to at this time? On January 7th, an issue a few days later, he handed down a guilty verdict in a drunk driving case. Remarkably, I didn't know the offender. A few days later, on January 10th, he accepted a guilty plea on a burglary charge from Butch Lyons, age 18. Lyons, barely out of high school, had been a classmate of my brother's. I remember as a young boy walking to town with Corky, my brother, and happening upon Lyons in an alley near his house. He was deep in a youthful project that was like my backyard Boy Scout merit badge projects, and yet different, too. He was about to set fire to a meticulously constructed tower of wooden matches, all surrounding a little green army man, whose aggressive bayonet-thrusting stance looked rather pathetic under the circumstances. I observed the fiery execution, looked at Butch Lyons' broad forehead glowing in the flames, his freckled cheeks, his really quite handsome features, and I thought, this is the face of evil. Many years later, when I mentioned the incident to my father, he said, "That's interesting. I sent his father up for arson." A few days after the Lyons burglary plea, the paper reports on the judge's interesting treatment of an escaped and recaptured prisoner from out of town. The prisoner, while being transported from one facility to another, simply walked away when the incompetent deputy in charge of him stopped en route to attend to some personal business, leaving the police car unlocked and the prisoner unrestrained. "He practically invited him to escape," lamented Judge Cartkeat, publicly rebuking the lawman. And by way of acknowledging that the prisoner was, after all, only human, the judge handed down no punishment whatsoever for the escape. What is a small town? In Chapter 1 of Campus Sexpot, when Linda Franklin waits outside for her first ride home with Don Cowfield, which I just read to you, he's surprised to find her standing right next to his Carmen Ghia. "Oh, I know all the cars here," she explains, and we certainly did. A four-page photo spread in my freshman yearbook treats cars on the campus. 14 rods are pictured, along with their extremely cool owners, all guys, of course. Nichols with his 47 Ford, Casanetto next to his 54 Chevy, Liliadol in his 56 Merc, Hill with his 57 Ford. Some of them, like Quayle's 40 Chevy, look like getaway cars from a gangster movie. The boxy 53 Dodge my brother drove, even though he was as cool as any of these guys, failed to qualify for inclusion. It was unmodified out of the factory, and the killer disqualification, it belonged not to Corky, but to my mother. Corky, it's a name I learned to answer to. In a small town, if you have an older brother, everyone calls you by his name because they knew him first. To a young boy gathering impressions of the world he's entering, nothing discourages him about the intelligence of adults more than this repeated blunder. Those cars, by the way, a week ago, I was back in this hometown for a signing in the bookstore, and everyone about my age, I would look at them and say, "Do I know you?" And this one guy was kind of slouching, and he says, "You might." Turns out he was one of these cool guys with a cool car, but I hadn't seen him for over 40 years. And he'd gone to Arizona and had a successful career as a banker. He bragged to me about how he'd gotten for his house in Arizona and so on. And he's back in town, retired, living in the area. And I said, "Well, my brother's living here, too." He says, "Well, if you see him, tell him I'm driving a 65 Cobra." A lot of growth, a lot of personal growth. And I'll read you the end of this this chapter, wrap it up. A small town is a defensively cocky place, quick to brag about its superiority before you can make fun of it. We lived in a gold rush town. Reminders were everywhere, even in the name itself. Mexican miners from the state of Sonora were the first to pull riches from its soil. On Saturdays, when I washed the windows at Calvert's Store for Men, I also washed the plaque on the building saying it had housed the town's first Wells Fargo office. Nearby Columbia was called Hildreth's Diggings in the 1850s, and friendly Ken Hildreth grinned at me from the far end of the trumpet section in the 1960s. Another schoolmate, lucky to be alive in an unusual sense, was a direct descendant of George Donner, leader of the Donner Party. George and his wife, Tamsin, didn't make it, but their children did, and he was the great-great-great-grandchild of this couple. And people used to make jokes about him, you know, at the cafeteria. "You're looking pretty hungry there, John." We were cocky about our elevation, too. Borrowing glory from the Sierras, which reached over 14,000 feet, we fancied ourselves mountain people despite our modest foothill elevation of 1,800 feet. Our name for outsiders, flatlanders, is common among vain mountain folk, but we had a special name for the outside world in general. If someone said, she married a guy from down below, we instantly knew what that meant about him. Not one of us. Different in a way that ruled out full mutual understanding, and why would anyone live down below anyway? The locator applied to towns in the valley, the San Francisco Bay Area, and points south all the way to L.A. On one occasion, a Sonoran who learned I was living in Indiana asked how I liked it down below. Linda Franklin does not use this expression in Campus Sexpot, but she does use another Sonora-ism, showing that Kobe picked up a few of our habits in his 18 months among us. Rebellious Linda is no town booster, and early in Campus Sexpot, she says to Don, the kids in school here think the world begins and ends in this little town. They're content to go to the show on Saturday night. Go to the show. At the time when she speaks, there were two movie houses in town, so you'd expect her to say, go to a show. But in Sonora, one would always go to the show. For many years, there was just one theater in town called the Uptown Theater, always the elevation brag, and go to the show stuck even after another theater opened at the lower end of the main street. One of the first movies I saw at the Uptown was High Noon, which was filmed partly on location in the scrub oak countryside around Sonora and in small towns a few miles away, Columbia and Tuolumne. Some of my brother's closest friends appeared in one scene, playing outside the church where the marshal, Gary Cooper, fruitlessly seeks the townspeople's help in the expected showdown at noon. During filming, the movie's casting director visited our elementary school and plucked these lucky third graders from the classroom, bestowing film immortality on them. Lowly kindergartners like me, who put in most of the day looking at Mrs. Dawson's legs from the naptime floor mats, were not candidates for greatness, nor were the eighth graders like my sister, who resented the privilege perversely given the third graders. Her only consolation was a glimpse of Grace Kelly at a restaurant in town. Pity even more the third graders not chosen to go with their classmates, like my brother. Apparently it was boys with long or messy hair who were chosen, so he can blame his casting failure on my mother and her enforcement of, to use her favorite encomium, the clean-cut look in her boys. In a small town, enmity accumulates, a fact that High Noon captures well. Coexistence is an essential art in such a place. If you see your enemy every day, you can't very well treat him like one. Instead, you display a noble civility. My father showed his mastery of this skill most notably with the Jordans, our neighbors across the street. They were important to me because their tubby dog was on permanent loan to our family. Brownie was fed by the Jordans, he slept there, and was covered by their medical plan. But every morning after breakfast, he would trot across the street to play with us, or on hot days, to sleep on the smooth concrete of our covered front porch. One night, however, I discovered that the Jordans were the enemy. It was election night, and my father had challenged an incumbent judge who hadn't been challenged in 35 years. Success was uncertain, even doubtful. The Jordans had invited my father's opponent and his supporters to their house for an anticipated victory celebration. The nature of the gathering became obvious to us as we watched the cars gather. Even I, just 9 years old, knew that scheduling such a party right across the street showed appalling taste. As the evening wore on and it became clear from the radio reports that my father would be the victor, by a 2-to-1 margin it would turn out, the cars began to slink away from the Jordans' house. My brother and I tracked the departures through the window, identifying the would-be revelers by name for my father's many supporters in our house. My father disliked his opponent. I knew this even though he rarely revealed such feelings. When the loser and his wife backed out of our neighbor's driveway and their car got stuck in a ditch, my brother and I threw hoots of ridicule into the dark street until my mother pulled us away from the window. My father never said a word about that party, neither to us nor, I'm sure, to the Jordans. He continued waving greetings across the road as cheerfully as ever. He was generous and large-hearted. He also liked Brownie an awful lot. There's a quietly moving scene in High Noon that to me is a snapshot of my father's professional life. It shows the marshal alone at his desk, sorting through his badges in anticipation of the posse that will never arrive to help him. It is the portrait of a man laboring without complaint on behalf of others. In Sonora, when the townspeople saw that the light was on in the courthouse long after hours, high in the third floor chambers, they knew that the judge was working toward a thoughtful decision about someone's life, a decision that would admit as much kindness as the law allowed. When I saw High Noon at the Uptown Theater, I saw it with my father. It's the only movie I remember seeing with him. I was so deeply stirred by the marshal's perilous solitude that afterward I felt the need to choose my words of comment very carefully. As we crossed Washington Street to our car, I said, he had a lot of courage. My father said, he sure did. I was 6 years old. Courage was a new word for me, and I was glad I had used it correctly. Thank you.